Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hey guys, how you doing? Have you used your voice-activated software yet on your cell phones recently?
Yeah, man. I use Waze all the time. She kind of sounds like Siri, but I'm really getting on that Google lady. She's pretty smooth.
She's too cheerful for me.
Yeah, I think I might be in love with her.
Oh, Tosin, what about you?
Yeah, you know what? I think I use all the time to do all my dictations. It makes life easier.
There you go. Why do you ask, man?
They're getting a little too realistic, too creepily, eerily realistic. I'm starting to have human emotions for these robotic assistants. I don't know what the fix is, but we're going to be talking about that and much more tonight on The Drill Down. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
I'm Tosin Anafawakin.
And I'm Chris Bernor.
This week, the Onion router makes the NSA cry, Samsung gets no love from President Obama, the real voice of Siri has been found, Nest reboots the smoke detector, and everything you thought about piracy is wrong. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand rail. And subscribe to us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I just have a couple things that I wanted to share with you guys. One of them is I saw Gravity, the Alfonso Cuarón thriller, space thriller, over the weekend. I saw it in a 3D IMAX presentation, and I have to say, it is amazing. It is one of the most sort of visceral experiences, and in particular, so like realistic, a very realistic space experience. A space movie like this I haven't seen since 2001, and I mean in the sense that there's
the year or the movie,
since the movie 2001, Stanley Kubrick's 2001, and I mean that in the sense that there's a real sense of verisimilitude in what's on screen. I really feel like you're there. In fact, there's several moments in this movie, without giving any spoilers away, there's several moments that are shot POV, so you really get a very real sense of that you're actually in space, floating in space. George Clooney and Sandra Bullock star in this. And once again, it's not giving any spoilers away in the first 10 minutes of the movie, in the first 5 minutes of the movie, really. They're working on a space shuttle, doing a spacewalk repair, and they get hit with debris from an oncoming satellite that was fired upon by Russian missiles, and the debris takes out the space shuttle, and they're essentially stranded in space. So and the movie just propels from there.
So how does this film rank so far against a lot of the films you've seen this year?
I mean, I would have to put it definitely in the top. I would say in the top five films of the year. The better films for me are probably going to be more smaller independent films like Mud, for example, which is an independent film featuring Matthew McConaughey that was released earlier in the year. But it's definitely, I think, the one of the most compelling big tentpole blockbuster films that I've seen of the year. And I think that that Sandra Bullock is on her way to Academy Award nomination for this. The other thing that I wanted, and I know you guys haven't seen Gravity yet, and maybe we'll talk about it a little bit more when you guys get a chance to see it. So The other thing I wanted to talk about is I'm building a MAME cabinet. And MAME is a multi-arcade emulator that is intended to emulate classic arcade coin-op games. And this is something I'm putting together for my work office. I got a hold of an actual Neo Geo coin-op cabinet, which is basically, you know, big pieces of MDF board in a coin-op framework, and it's got the all the joystick and the buttons intact. And so what I'm doing with that is I've got an old computer that I had lying around. I wiped it completely, put in a new OS, and I've installed MAME, which is the multi-arcade machine emulator. And right now I'm in the process of getting ROMs, which are the coin-op, the actual coin-op ROMs on there, and getting the MAME to recognize it. And it's a little bit of a puzzle because there's not a whole lot of documentation on doing this, and and development on MAME has sort of slowed to a halt within the last 10 years. So there's not a lot of development on it either. So it's basically a lot of searching around the internet trying to find, you know, going on message boards and obscure sites that have, you know, haven't been updated, to try and figure out how to put this together. But it's possible. I know it's possible, and I'm determined to do it, because I'm going to create the end goal is to create an arcade cabinet that will play literally every single arcade ROM that has ever been produced.
Wow. Mm. What are you getting the display for? Are you just going to use an old CRT or something?
I'm just going to use an old CRT. Yeah, exactly. And the CRT will plug into the video card that's already existing on the computer.
And you can sort of come up with a version of controls that are going to be you can have enough controls to do the very, because, you know, old arcade games had unique controls to a particular game.
That's sort of the missing link. And they sell a board, which I already have, which I already bought. It's a small circuit board, and it connects the arcade standard, which is called JAMA, and it stands for Japanese Amusement something something something. It connects the harness, which is connected to the arcade controls, to the interface. It basically plugs into a USB interface on the computer, and it will allow the computer to detect the controls from the arcade harness and translate those into controls for the individual ROMs. It's the cabinet has a joystick and six buttons, so it really only two sets of joysticks and six buttons, so it really only will be effective for games that use that kind of control. So games like Centipede or Tron or Tempest, games that had unique controls, it wouldn't really play well on. But that's it. That's what I've been doing in the last week. And with that, let's jump into our headlines. First, right off the bat, the National Security Agency has made repeated attempts to develop attacks against people using Tor, the Onion Router, which is a popular tool designed to protect online anonymity. And in fact, it's a tool that was developed by the government in the first place, funded by the U.S. government, primarily the State Department, Department of Defense, in the first place. Top secret NSA documents disclosed by Edward Snowden, there's Edward Snowden again, reveal that the NSA's current successes against Tor rely on identifying users and then attacking vulnerable software on their computers. But the documents suggest that the fundamental security of the Tor service remains intact. In fact, one of the NSA documents is a presentation titled "Tor Stinks." And it says, we'll never be able to de-anonymize all Tor users all the time. With manual analysis, we can de-anonymize a very small fraction of Tor users. And the presentation says that the agency has had no success in de-anonymizing a user in response to a specific request. And it goes on to call Tor the king of high secure, low latency internet anonymity. The way Tor works is it bounces its users' internet traffic through several other computers using relays and nodes to keep it anonymous and avoid online censorship tools. So the upshot is that here is an actual system that the NSA has proven that they cannot crack. They can't crack this. And the only way that they've been able to exploit people using Tor is to identify the people and then attack their individual systems instead of attacking the traffic coming from Tor.
That seems like their strategy with a lot of the encryption attacks too. Essentially, Tor and these encryption algorithms like are pretty secure. The problem is, you know, as things pass through the internet, I think the biggest best analogy I can think of is like chinks in an armor of like a knight in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. I mean, he might be wearing, you know, super thick armor that itself might be essentially impenetrable, but in order to be moving and functional, there are places where, you know, the message might be able to pass or it could be intercepted that do not involve that army before or after it gets out. It is kind of interesting knowing that, like, I mean, the U.S. government not only developed Tor, it was developed by the, I think, Naval Lab, but the U.S. government still provides something like 60% of the funding for the Tor project.
Yep.
While at the same time,
I mean, it does have legitimate uses.
That shows the fragmentation what's going on in this kind of development. Tor, you know, was built for maintaining a level of secrecy and privacy and encryption to keep the bad guys, so to speak, away from getting access to the kinds of work that was being done by DARPA and the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory and so on. It's onion routing for a reason. Tor is the onion router. And I feel like one of the things that it's done is it's gone beyond this. It's gone, you know, it's too powerful for people like the NSA to scan and jump into. So in some ways, it's like the Skynet of the government. They created it, and yet they can't control it.
Yep, yep, yep. That's an interesting analogy that you make there. Because it is. It's a system that was invented by the government, and it's out of their control. So, okay, moving on here. Samsung can import some smartphones and tablet computers into the U.S. after President Barack Obama decided not to veto a ban won by Apple in a patent infringement dispute. The Korean company asked Obama to overturn the ban ordered by the U.S. International Trade Commission on public policy grounds, which is the same relief that Obama gave Apple in August from an order barring imports of the iPhone 4S. Forcing Samsung to change its designs has been a victory for Apple. So this is essentially Samsung lost the same appeal for imports that Apple won back in August. This is like a double victory for Apple because it's a failure of Samsung to be able to get appeal from the same request.
I didn't understand why Obama was able to step in on the import ban previously. I mean, it seems like the executive should just not have that power.
I think we talked about that on the show back then. It did seem a little unusual, but it was an order that came like through his office to the International Trade Commission, and they felt that it was in Apple's it was in the interest of the American consumers for Apple to be allowed to overturn the ban. And it's interesting that it almost seems like favoritism, doesn't it?
Yeah, it feels very fair. I mean, yeah. It's like, oh, well, Apple's an American company. Samsung is not.
I think it's also favoritism towards, you know, the American people as well as business owners, because quite a lot of businesses, you know, have started converting at least their, you know, high workforce, the people, the elder statesmen, so to speak, into using iOS devices. And so, you know, bans, large bans of this nature affect the productivity of those organizations and cause them to have to rethink their structure. So I'm sure, like, I'm sure the decision that Obama had to make probably was influenced by many other realms too. So many other, you know, corporate. And probably even, you know, senatorial people who just enjoy Apple devices.
You're probably right.
Nope.
Can't like John McCain, who sits there on playing solitaire on his iPhone during like here. this is really one of those things where the president does have the IOC,
the International Trade Commission, ITC.
The ITC, yeah, the International Trade Commission. They're still subject to the administration. They're not a court like our third branch of the government court, like our co-equal branch justice system. So the president has the ability to say, I respect what you had to say. Too bad you can't enforce it. Apple, you're fine. Samsung, you're not.
Yeah.
And obviously there's special interests involved, but it's the general interest of this country. We export devices, or at least the designs for devices, to over half the world. And these devices are the product and mainstay of the most powerful, you know, manufacturing technology company on the planet, and let alone one of the most powerful companies on the planet. And we simply can't afford to stop that kind of productivity. If you think about America's interests, when we talk about interests, our ability to sway hearts and minds with this technology that is, you know, adaptive and persuasive and usable for almost anyone. That's the kind of stuff that really is important to our ability to move culture forward. So the more people that are out there using Apple products, the more people out there are tweeting, the more people that are doing all this stuff, this is what, you know, is good for us. So
speaking of Apple products, Apple's got an announcement coming up on October 22nd.
You think they're getting married? You think they're having a baby?
they're having a baby. They're having a fifth generation iPad baby is what they're expected to announce.
It's really four and a half generation, right?
Well, I mean, iPad there 4 you is go really again, iPad. Dwayne, quibbling over the semantics of the generation of the nomenclature.
It's fourth generation iPad, people. I'm just saying.
We don't know for sure.
The current one, the 3S.
What was the fifth generation, fourth generation? So you're not counting the iPad Mini as a generation?
No, that's a different product altogether. You don't put the iPod Touch next to the iPod Classic. You say the fifth generation iPod Touch.
So they're expected to update the iPad line. It's supposed to be thinner, lighter design, akin to the iPad Minis, with an improved camera. It'll run Apple's new 64-bit A7 chip. It'll be upgraded with a Retina display, and it's not sure whether the Touch ID fingerprint sensor that's in the iPhone S is going to be in the new iPads, though that's been rumored. Again, with all things Apple, it's all a rumor until they finally announce it. And then when they finally announce it, it's like usually it's like oh half of that stuff we already heard in the rumor, so it's no there's no real new news there.
Don't you remember the days when we were truly excited and things were caught us off guard?
Exactly. Yeah, that was the last time that really happened for me, I would have to say, would be the iPhone.
The iPad.
I was a little bit, well, I don't know. We pretty much knew that the iPad was coming.
There was a lot of data about the iPad, but it wasn't like really, really there. I would say the biggest thing is that it's funny because you're like, I have to report on the rumor.
Yeah.
Because when the real news happens, the rumors will have covered it, which is bizarre. I don't know.
That's very indicative of the whole tech news journalism in general. It's like you kind of got to cover rumors like that because you're right. You don't want to be last to the gate with an announcement like that.
We've seen the related device, the iPhone 5S. If the iPad Mini were to come out and have different colors and plastic, I wouldn't be surprised, although I don't know if they have the market is big enough to support that kind of thing. But really, the idea of a Touch ID on the flagship device, or even just the Mini, because that is an important device to them, isn't too crazy an idea. You know, like they're buying these bits of hardware, and the more economies of scale they can get, the better. Just like how they rolled out Lightning in quick succession after the iPhone 5 across all devices, rolling out Touch ID doesn't seem like a very difficult thing or very hard thing. So
Can I give a theory on what's going on at Apple? This is just a theory, and it's a little of a long shot. This would normally go under my like predictions for 2014, think the end of the year. I think Apple is currently in a what you might call setting the groundwork stage for something bigger coming along.
That's clear because of the A7 chip and what's possible when it comes to quickly redrawing animations on it. Like this
yeah.
is the device that is designed to be used for more than what they're using it for now.
Yeah, particularly the fact that it's a 64-bit chip. I mean, does the iPad have more than 4 gigs of RAM? I really doubt
no,
it.
No, but it's not about the 4 gigs of RAM. You don't the 4 gigs of RAM it's not built in the same way that a Windows or Intel chip is built. The 64 bits allow it to do redrawing it allows it to redraw images and all these other things really quickly. Just the same way a console with 64-bit or a video card with 64-bit long before it had 4 gigs of RAM. We have 200 512-bit video cards today that have 2 gigs of RAM. It's not because they can't address all the RAM without going that high. It's because they're doing the kinds of calculations that require that level of bandwidth.
Yeah, that certainly is a possibility. I seriously think they are working on particularly something with the Apple TV that is going to integrate across these devices, and that the sort of releases we're seeing now with a few of upgrade to some big hardware stuff underneath imply eventually they are going to do something bigger. I mean, I agree. I guess you could just see it as just a way of making an update, screen faster for something like Retina.
Well, I mean, if you want to deliver, if you want to deliver 4K,
I really think that there come sometime next year they are going to.
Yeah, no, if you want to deliver 4K, motion graphic video game level experience on a screen that's as big as a 46-inch TV or something like that. Yeah, I mean, this chip is going to get you there really quickly, no problem. If you're going to deliver, if you just want to have that kind of power so that you can have an iPad that rivals the power of a Windows or OS X type of device, there's that too. The worry, I think, for a lot of geeks is the idea that Apple may eventually want to take this technology and go back to the desktop with it, and thus move toward a proprietary desktop experience when it comes to the core of that desktop, the microprocessor running in there. That's a worry for a lot of geeks because we all know how that turned out last time. So I think that there's it's one of those things where we have to like wait and see. But yeah, I really think that you're right, Chris. This is leading toward a device that is far more powerful, far more capable. Or at least it has different feature sets and use cases than the device we're seeing it in, because it is, for lack of a better term, overkill.
What would be the downside to having this processor in a desktop system?
Well, when you're using the best chips that are available to everyone and you have the infrastructure that Intel has to roll these chips out, you're in a good way. But when you're doing what Apple did before, where they had a proprietary version of a RISC chip and they were doing all these tweaks to this IBM architecture, just like how these A devices, A7, A4 through A7, they're all tweaks on ARM architecture, you're not going to be able to continue to compete. That's why if you look at like an OS 9, like the pre-Intel Macs, the Mac didn't take off until Intel chips were in them. When Intel chips were in them and you had like the MacBook Pro with the Intel chip, that's when Apple's desktop and laptop computers really skyrocketed and were universal and were attacked by everyone because they were so fast. Intel makes fast chips. They understand the desktop. If Apple wants to move back to a proprietary chip, they're going to lose a lot of stock for sure. And, they won't be able to keep up. Because the Intel-AMD war is what fueled that speed increase, moving away from megahertz, focusing on the bandwidth of the chip and the North Bridge and the South Bridge, all these things. You needed that kind of competition, and Apple's not in a place to compete on that level.
Let's talk about Lavabit and Lavabit's founder, Ladar Levinson. He recently did a interview with NPR with All Things Considered. And, we talked about Lavabit when they first shut down, when Ladar Levinson shut down the company. He did that in the face of a government demand that he turn over the encryption keys and computer code that would unlock the data of his 400,000 customers. And back at the time, he couldn't talk about it because he was under a gag order. But some federal court documents have been unsealed, and he was free to talk about this with Melissa Block on NPR, which I thought was a fascinating interview. He basically mentioned like the key piece that he wasn't able to talk about at the time was that the government was asking for the private SSL encryption key.
That is a huge yeah. moment for me. Like, there was a great quote on Hacker News, which I think really encapsulated what the significance of taking those SSL keys was, because that doesn't just give them access to everything. Mm-hmm. Those keys essentially function as LavaBit's identity online. By seizing those keys, US government is claiming the right to impersonate LavaBit online.
Right.
And also the fact that, like, one of the reasons why he shut down LavaBit is because he knew that previous companies who had been in the situation had actually gotten court orders barring them from closing their business. Yeah, so he basically shut down before.
Once those companies announced they were thinking about shutting down, the court would send them an order saying, you can't shut down, you have to remain open. So he shuttered the doors immediately in order to avoid those orders. And in order to avoid paying $5,000 a day for not providing the keys.
And for basically, I mean, this is how we know that the U.S. government has previously ordered companies to stay in business. Like, I, like, can't even fathom, like, a government ordering a business to stay in business. Like, it's essentially stealing the business.
So purpose of convincing the consumer that they're getting the same product that they signed up for.
Yeah, but also as an owner of a business, I mean, like, one of the things that, you know, a business has the right to own itself. Like, if it's not doing well, if you need to sell it, if you need to shut down or liquidate it, like, mm-hmm. It's essentially like losing ownership of the business. I mean, if Microsoft says, or, you know, the federal government says to Google, you have to continue providing a search service. Like, what if Google decides that they need to abandon search service? Like, it's just an unfathomable intrusion, I think. A company to stay in business with a particular product and market.
Doesn't it sound like a new school mob mentality? Where, you know,
it does.
In the day you had the mob bosses knocking on doors for their funds or for whatever they need, and this time that role is being played by the government. Pretty scary concept.
Yeah. I mean, the sole reason that they wanted LavaBit to stay open and these other companies to stay in business was so that they can have free reign over their SSL and essentially their consumer base. And
like, it's like it's saying that, hey, look, we want you to stay in business, and you can't change your marketing, and you can't change your description of your product, and you can't tell people we're doing this. So people are going to continue to use the service thinking that it is legitimately secure, and yet we will be breaching that security day by day. You, as the founder and visionary of this product or service, will know that, and you can do nothing about it. So you're forced to live a lie. You're forced to move against your own, for lack of a better term, religious beliefs about the, you know, the organization or device or service that you have spent whatever time in your life creating. You know, that's a fundamental problem.
Yeah.
That's the thing that really has continued to bother me about this whole thing more than the fact that the government is spying. I mean, the fact that the government is spying is not something that is surprising to me. The scale is somewhat surprising to me. The real thing that bothers me is this whole, like, web of sort of enforced complicitness with it that one cannot. Yeah. And essentially, like, forcing people who have done nothing wrong, literally mm-hmm. done nothing mm-hmm. except create a business, to be forced, you know, to, I don't know, it boggles me. It's something that honestly, like, as someone who, so I was a German minor, and I've studied some authoritarian regimes in the 20th century, and I've never heard of anything like that, of a government, like, you know, basically forcing people to stay in business.
a free government, a non-fascist government.
Doing any government, like even fascist governments, I've never heard of them doing that.
Well, I mean, you had to keep the munitions plant open. I'm not calling our government fascist. I'm just saying that this is not the type of behavior that you see in an open government, regardless of the security needs. Like, these people are complaining about security. I don't mean to be like, I don't mean to be a jerk or anything, but find a better way. Having the ability to look at everybody in Lava Bay because you want to trace down a couple people is laziness. I'm going to say it's laziness. No. You need to find a better way. You need to have people dedicated to chasing down these individuals. You need to be doing things like, you need to be doing things that don't involve you just seeing every behind the kimono of everybody's thing. Mm-hmm. This is not me being some sort of like crazy liberal or anything. This is me being a concerned citizen about the privacies, the lack of quartering troops, which is really what's happening here. They're basically saying, I can park a guy in your inbox just in case, because it's more convenient for me to park my guy in your inbox than it is for me to chase another person. That's quartering troops. That is against the amendment. We can go into other amendments too, but it's janky. It's not one of those things where we're looking at some broad scope, the NSA spying on your stuff. It's one of those things where this is a laid out tactical approach, a methodical, tactical, predetermined approach to taking away the rights of the individual. And it's premeditated, and that's what makes it so egregious.
Yeah, I feel like we're as a society, as a country, we're really going to reach critical mass on this fairly soon. I think we've reached the point where the awareness of this is past the threshold for comfort that for most Americans.
I think that's the case for geek America. I don't think that's the case for mainstream America yet. I think there's a long way to go. There's a lot of distractions right now between the government shutdown, the debt ceiling, Syria, what happened in Kenya. This is just not top of mind for most people, especially because it just seems to be part of the ongoing story of how the government is tracking people, which everyone's like, oh, of course they were doing that. It's just the way they were tracking, the premeditation involved, the focus on, the shotgun approach. All these nuances are not things that I'm convinced the people of the United States are going to be into. Mm-hmm. They, unless it's like exposed on Nightline, and it's not exactly the kind of thing that's going to get Nightline a lot of guff. So I mean, I'm glad that they were on NPR. Melissa Block was able to get that out there.
Yep.
And oftentimes NPR is behind the times of technology. It's cool to see that NPR was on top of this story, but it really needs to get to a major news outlet as an exclusive in prime time in order to begin to show people the full weight of law. I feel like what we're going to see is some sort of documentary like The Corporation or something that shows up on Netflix rather than an actual, balls out, this is what's going on in the government and we need to stop it kind of thing.
Yep. All right.
Yeah, I think it's smart that it's sort of continued on so long, because I think that's the only way that it's going to be, really sort of get that mainstream connection, barring something like what you were just talking about, Dwayne. So,
all right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend is one that I hadn't previously heard of before yesterday, called The Circle. It's written by Dave Eggers. The description from the publisher is as such: when May Holland is hired to work for The Circle, the world's most powerful internet company, she feels she's been given the opportunity of a lifetime. The Circle, run out of a sprawling California campus, links users' personal emails, social media, banking, and purchasing with their universal operating system, resulting in one online identity and a new age of civility and transparency. What begins as the captivating story of one woman's ambition and idealism soon becomes a heart-racing novel of suspense, raising questions about memory, history, privacy, democracy, and the limits of human knowledge. So,
guys, it sounds like the net. 1995, it kinda Sandra does. Bullock. That's exactly what it is. Which all things go back to Sandra Bullock in the net when it comes to this surveillance world that we're living in. They have your ID, they have your driver's license. Who can forget that?
They caught me ordering pizza off the internet. So but it sounds fascinating. It's like a techno thriller. It's just
Will Smith knew of this too. They had everything on him.
What was that movie? The movie that he was in.
Enemy of the State.
Thank you.
Oh, he was in that?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the one where
And Wild West.
Where Gene Hackman sort of reprised his role from The Conversation. It wasn't quite the same character, but it was more or less modeled after the same character.
And let's not forget Wild West, where the government made giant spider robots to take out terrorists.
I tried to forget about the Wild West until you brought that up again. All right. So for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, all you have to do is for that free audiobook trial, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free copy of The Circle and the 30-day trial to check out their service. Even if you don't like the service, you can quit Audible and you still get to keep The Circle by Dave Eggers or any other book that you have chosen for that trial forever. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Siri, who are you really? Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas, Tosin Anufowakin, and Christopher Bernor. For the past 2 years, she's been a pocket and purse accessory to millions of Americans. She is Siri, Apple's voice-activated virtual assistant introduced to the masses with the iPhone 4S on October 4th, 2011. Behind this groundbreaking technology, there's a real woman. While the ever-secretive Apple has never identified her, all signs indicate that the original voice of Siri in the U.S. is a voiceover actor who laid down recordings for a client 8 years ago. She had no idea that someday she'd be speaking to more than 100 million people through a not-yet-invented phone. Her name is Susan Bennett, and she lives in suburban Atlanta. And I should point out that this story was exclusively broken by CNN. She, for 4 hours a day, every day in July 2005, she holed up in her home recording booth. Hour after hour, she read nonsensical phrases and sentences so that the people that she works with, the techs, can work their magic by pulling out vowels and consonants, syllables, diphthongs, and playing with her pitch and speed. And then those snippets of her voice were synthesized in a process called concatenation that builds words, sentences, and paragraphs out of those snippets. And that's how
Concatenation is interesting. You'd use it in Excel too. It's how you combine. It's a fancy word for the combination of data. So they'll do that with audio data. I mean, this woman's voice is, it's actually bigger than Siri. If you were using Yahoo's, or not Yahoo's, if you're using MapQuest navigation software back before iOS 6, you were using the only navigation software that was free that allowed you to listen to music and also like give you voice-by-voice turn directions. This is back when Google only had voice-by-voice turn directions on their operating system, Android. Her voice was the voice. She's been doing GPS software for a while. Commercials, automated teller machines, the voice of Delta Airlines, and she was also the public address system in places. they didn't go and get her because she was random. They went and got her because she had been around in this voice authority
right.
recording she, space.
Interactive
she's a,
voice.
She's the pro.
Yep, yep, yep. It's a
she's virtually the inner world person right. of the technology you know universe.
Right.
So do we know there are other things that she does, or does Apple sort of have the exclusive rights to this?
No, that's what I'm saying, dude. This is long before she was yeah. in Siri. She was doing GPS navigation software, and Apple didn't hire her for Siri. Siri hired her for Siri, and then Apple bought Siri.
Right, right. Nuance.
So, gotcha.
Exactly.
This is the thing. She's been around for a bit. That's why she was recording in 2005, because that's when Siri was doing its thing. Again, MapQuest's phenomenal, and it's still really good navigation software for the iPhone or iPad. That's her voice. You know, she's been doing this for a long time. It's just that Siri is when she went from being in the province of the geek to, you know, what the Matrix guys might call the real world, you know?
And in fact, once again, Apple has never admitted that she is the voice. CNN hired a voice analysis expert, and they ran her voice through special software to identify that her voice was actually the voice of Siri. She remembers doing all the voice texts, but then her voice has been digitized and mixed up and used to say different phrases. So it's a combination of her original recordings and then sort of the, as we talked about before, the concatenation that they did on their end to digitize and rephrase her voice.
What they need to do is get Major Roddenberry's voice from three different series of Star Trek. Yeah.
And every movie.
And then use that as the voice of the future.
Yeah.
Because Major Roddenberry was the voice of every computer you ever heard in any of the Next Generation era Star Trek movies and TV shows. And that would move me.
She was the Major Roddenberry was interactive voice response before there was even a name for it, when it was only a theoretical concept.
Yeah. I mean, and they did stuff to her voice to change it. They made it sound human, yet at the same time, they made it also sound somewhat robotic and out of touch, which is interesting because the character that she played in. Yeah, the character that she played on the Next Generation Era series was a telepathic and an empathic being. So when you saw the woman, she was totally in touch with your emotions. And when you heard the woman disembodied, she was totally out of touch with your emotions. It was brilliant. So, I mean, just a bit of sci-fi lore. And when you think about Google and these guys chasing down the Star Trek vision, Major Roddenberry is a big part of that.
You're absolutely right. You know, and the other thing about this article, too, is that keep in mind that since this applies to iOS iOS 6. Since then, in iOS 7, the voice that they use for Siri is different. So, and I think it is it's an actual fully computerized voice.
It is somewhat different. I don't know how, but yeah, iOS 5 and iOS iOS 6 had a different voice than iOS 7 Siri. So this is a, you know, Siri's in her third generation now, and it's going to be interesting to see how people respond. With also now, I mean, you have the option for a male voice.
That's right.
So which is interesting, because if you ever listen to the New York City Subway, they've got their own computerized voice they use for information and instructions. Information's always the woman. Instructions are always the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of wonder psychologically. I mean, that says something about our society. Sociologically, it says something about our system. But psychologically, I wonder how the male's voice does when it comes to asking you questions and so on. I feel like women's voices are often used more because they are, for lack of a better term, considered non-threatening. So that's it's interesting.
Yeah, I can't wait till I get Jarvis. Give me Jarvis, and I'll be.
I mean, Jarvis is great. I like Alice from the Resident Evil.
So let's move on to another topic here. The London School of Economics and Political Science has released a new policy urging the UK government to look beyond the lobbying efforts of the entertainment industry when it comes to future copyright policy. According to their report, there's ample evidence that file sharing is helping rather than hurting the creative industries. The report shows that the entertainment industries are actually doing quite well. The digital gaming industry is thriving, publishing sector is stable, and the U.S. film industry is breaking record after record. Even the music industry is doing relatively well. Revenue from concerts, publishing, and digital sales has increased significantly since the early 2000s. And while recorded music revenues show a decline, there's little evidence that piracy is the lead cause. The authors further argue that file sharing can actually benefit the creative industries in various ways. They mention the success of the SoundCloud service, where artists can share their work for free through Creative Commons licenses. The promotional effect of YouTube, where copyrighted songs are shared to promote sales. And the fact that the research shows that file sharers actually spend more money on entertainment than those who don't share. And
yeah, I think there are a whole bunch of problems with these pieces right here. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why, I don't know, you look at something like the App Store, it's highly successful, and there's no ability to file share here, right? You look at some of these things that they're quoting, and they're like, oh, we can't prove that the recording industry is suffering from piracy, but they can't disprove it either. And they're also not looking at it from a capitalistic point of view. They're looking at it from an academic point of view. If you're a movie theater or a movie maker, if you're the MPAA or the RIA, you're looking at that lack of those people who are viewing your movie for free.
Yeah,
you're looking at them as lost opportunity. There's an opportunity cost there. You've spent the money. It's in front of those eyeballs, and you get paid for eyeballs, and that's how advertising works. You get paid for the amount of eyeballs you have. That's why if you have, 300 million users, you'll get bought for $1 billion, as opposed to having, or 30 million users in the case of Instagram, you'll get bought for $1 billion. You have to have a lot of eyeballs looking at your stuff, and that's how they quantify value, by the amount of eyeballs. So I get what's being said here, and there is science to this, but the outlook is not that of the capital-focused industries that they're pursuing. So I just kind of feel like it's somewhat
self-serving.
It's somewhat self-serving. It's slightly partisan. It's not looking at it in. I mean, this article at least is not portraying this research in a completely open-minded way. In fact, it starts with piracy isn't killing the entertainment industry, scholars show. That's not what it's saying. It's saying that there's no definitive proof. There could be some proof that piracy is helping, but it could be proof. It's not definitive proof. I don't know. I just feel like this is one of those things where if I was listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Paula Poundstone would be like, so who's doing the study and why? It's just, I don't know. It's I'm not convinced by this article's layout of the facts that piracy is not a problem. I do think that price discrimination is something that piracy does solve for. So if you've mm-hmm, got some mm-hmm. people who can't afford that $12 movie ticket, and there's a way to show it to them online at the same time as it comes out of the movie, because you know that they're segmented that way, that's going to help. Like, there are people who wouldn't otherwise be seeing this stuff if it were pirated, and that's the difference. People who are like, I just can't afford to go to the movies, or I'm not really into this particular type of movie, but I'll see it because it's quickly and easily available for me. It's the equivalent of the Netflix guys like, oh, I'll watch it because it's on Netflix, but I wouldn't have gone to see the movie for it. I'll watch it because it's on TV because I wouldn't have gone to see it. They've just got to find a way to monetize those users, to give those users access in a cheap way, And that's really where the crux of the problem
and
is.
And I think that in a way, piracy indirectly influences that. When you get people like Louis C.K., for example, who charges so little for his concerts online mm-hmm. that it makes more sense to purchase them outright than it does to pirate them. Or I feel like even iTunes, the prices of individual songs was influenced by the by striking a balance between
Well, I don't think iTunes is the best example. I think it's wildly popular, but the fact is it costs 30 cents more than an Amazon or Google Play. The problem with iTunes also is that when you look at iTunes,
it's not really like the RIAA is suffering despite iTunes. The movie industry isn't suffering despite iTunes, but the music industry certainly is. And that's why the digital downloads continue to affect that. With Louis C.K., it's also very interesting because what he's able to do is have a PR machine that says, hey, guys, don't steal from me. I'm Louis C.K. I'm just this guy who's trying to make you laugh. I'm going to give it to you. It's going to be really easy to get. It's whatever. But if you go to any kind of tracking torrent site, you'll see the Louis C.K. stuff up there too, because there are certain people who just don't want to pay that $5. The big thing about Louis C.K. especially is he's not working with a huge production company to make a blockbuster film. And because of that, he's able to save a lot of his own money. And that's where the PR engine comes in. He's able to say, I'm living directly off of this stuff. Instead of when Lord of the Rings is made, the army of people who's putting together costumes and other special effects, they're mostly invisible or unfathomable to the user. And that's one of the reasons why the piracy continues to happen on that level. And Louis C.K. is able to break that down by saying, it's just me. It's me and like a few guys. You know, I'm getting the Beacon Theater. It's a cheap theater. I just want to make people laugh. And I think that's something to think about, too. How you package, how you present, going up against the MPAA or the RIAA, it feels like you're going up against the man. Whereas when you're going up against like a Louis C.K., it's a very different story.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys think about this? Chris and Towson, any
thoughts? I mean, I think the observation that piracy has sort of become this de facto price discrimination is interesting. My guess is a strong amount of that is part of it. I think there's also I think really what it gets down to is that we live in a sharing economy where, you know, there's a sort of element of virality, particularly to music, you know. And it just there isn't a sanctioned way to share music in the way that there was, you know, I mean, in the way that essentially radio has been for much of the existence of the professional music industry. Like, used to be, you know, radio was
that's
the
top
way
down, that, right?
Yeah. And that's just not, it's hardly there anymore. And so people have come up with their own way of sharing music, that is not sanctioned by the rights holders. And no one is really sure, you know, mm-hmm. where to go from there. But I think ultimately the problem is really people want to share stuff. I think that's really what's driving it. I mean, yes, there's some group of people that is never going to pay. There's right. some group of people that's just simply going to download it for the sake of having it. You know, those people who have like, you know, three human lifetimes worth of music on their computer. But
it's
I don't
also
think
like
those...
if you think about it, the sharing is like, I can share a song with you from iTunes. I really can. Or I can share a song with you from Amazon. Or I can share a song with you from Spotify. Or I can share a song with you from Pandora. When I say so with Pandora, you're going to share the station. I think you can share the idea that you listen to a song, but playing that song isn't necessarily going to happen. With Spotify, as long as you have an account and you're on a desktop, yes, that can happen. So a lot of people are saying, well, it's all about these streaming services. Who wants to own all this music? The management of the storage for all those people who have all that much audio data, that's a problem. But at the same time, people are like, I want that song. I don't want it to be so that if I stop paying $10, I lose my access to all this stuff that I love. Music is a very personal thing. That personalness, I don't know exactly what the word is. I think that's really – that the nature of the intimacy – is really tied into what Chris is saying. People want to share it. They want to share what's made them happy when they listen to it. And there's not, and the easiest way to do that is to send an email or whatever. Remember, these files are tiny compared to film files, right?
Yeah.
Maybe 8 megabytes for a really long song or something. That's well within the limit of most email providers. So there you go. You know, or you're on something like an AIM or something. You can yep. just, if anyone ever uses yep. that anymore, you can just shoot it to somebody else. So it's far more simpler to go and get the file and shoot it over than it is to kind of go through some complicated DRM focused program and share it. So it's a weird mentality there, and mm-hmm. it's also so reusable. How many times do you see a movie, right? If it's your favorite movie, you might see it 30 times in a lifetime.
if it's your favorite song, you might hear it 300 times in a lifetime, 500 times, 1,000 times. So because it's so small and because the value that you get out of it is so large, it's the sharing of music is definitely something that's got a higher barrier than the sharing of a film or a television show. And when you look at artists, really popular musical artists, you know, do very well compared to really popular movie artists. If you're a really popular movie artist in the 20th century, you might have hit 50 movies. Today, you know, you're hitting 25, 30. Whereas making a song, if you're a really popular music artist in the 20th century, you've got crazy hits, crazy albums. You know, the Rolling Stones are doing concerts and making hundreds of millions of dollars, whereas an actor with a top movie is going to make between $20 and $30 million. So music is just, it's a really, really efficient way to share a sentiment and feeling that only lasts 3 minutes and is really tiny. And that's something that they're going to have to really work on in order to figure out.
That's an interesting perspective on that. I thought about that, that the sort of the difference between movies and music as a as shareable commodities in relation to this discussion on piracy.
Yeah, no, but I will say that, you know, this isn't the first study that we've seen that has kind of demonstrated similar results. And I think in a recent episode, we also discussed how Netflix was using the piracy results to really drive their business and figure out what sort of content they should share. So, you know, I think it, you know, some of these aspects do go hand in hand and actually empower companies to make better decisions. Whether or not they choose to take these in light, we'll see. But hopefully, I think a lot of organizations are learning and maybe changes in sight. Maybe even for things as big and robust as the cable company.
I remember we had in discussion a while back. We saw a video where Kevin Spacey said, essentially, if you give the people quality and affordability and make it, you know, easily accessible for them, they're going to choose to pay for it rather than pirate it. And that's the kind of world that I wouldn't mind living in, where every desirable property is easily
available for you to gain access to for a reasonable price all the time.
Yep.
I think that we all agree with that. There's no doubt. It's just a question of what's the reasonable price for which person. Yep. How do you make that price discrimination happen? In the movie theater today, you can say, if you're a student, you're going to pay $4. If you're an adult, you're going to pay $8. And if you're a senior citizen, you're going to pay $6. You can't do that online just yet. At least Amazon used to sort of do it with Prime. You know, you'd get Prime, and you'd have, like, if you had an EDU account, you can get it more discounted. Maybe that's a way to go for these movie theaters, but for these guys. But I really think that that's a thing that we are going to have to continually work on. Frankly, there is some sharing going on in the TV and movie space, and that's happening with the sharing of Netflix accounts, the sharing of, as we read in the New York Times, the sharing of HBO Go accounts. Someone's mom's got an HBO Go account, and somebody jumps on and says, hey, I'm going to use this because my mom's only using the HBO on the TV, and I'm going to use the HBO Go myself, and I'm going to share it with a couple friends. And the HBO president said, yeah, we're not cracking down on that right now. So it's interesting to see how people are getting around it. But in the end, there's always going to be a black market, right?
Yeah.
It's just a question of how do you digitally, it's somewhat trackable. And when you're creating, when you've got the rules that we have around copyright, it's definitely something that is going to be a focus for a lot of people who are trying to make money off of an intangible thing. In an age where it's all about information sharing on a network specifically designed to allow as many people to share as much information as possible. You simply can't stop the internet.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
Unless you're Iran.
Right. Or Syria on occasion. Okay, let's move on here. A couple weeks ago, we talked about Nest, who the guys who rebooted the thermostat, the former developers of the iPhone, or I'm sorry, the iPad. I'm sorry,
iPod.
The iPod. Yes. Oh, talk about
the click wheel. These are the click wheel guys.
The click wheel guys. They rebooted the thermostat and created an interactive thermostat called Nest. And we talked about the rumor that they had a smoke detector coming out, and this week it actually did come out. It is, as the rumors had reported, called the Nest Protect. It retails for $129. It's on sale this November. It's going to be available through Amazon, Apple, Best Buy, and Home Depot. There's some interesting tidbits about the Nest Protect. It offers a female voice, which Nest says will resonate better with children when during periods of urgency, like fire. As typical with Nest products, Protect has a mobile component so users can monitor what's happening in their home, which it gives you notifications such as low battery alerts, something they're calling heads up, which is indicates that the device is sensing that smoke or carbon monoxide levels are rising. Emergency alarms can be received on your phone or iPad. In addition, there's an app called that the app features a what to do feature, which reminds you of recommended actions and one button access to emergency phone numbers. It's Wi-Fi enabled. You can connect it with the thermostat and other internet supported devices. We reported on that before. If you have multiple detectors in your home, Nest Protect can be wired together so you hear the alerts no matter where you are, even if the issue is isolated into one room. That's kind of revolutionary in the field of smoke detectors.
What's that last part? I didn't quite catch that.
So if you have multiple smoke detectors in your home and they're all Nest Protect detectors, which you would normally in a home, you'd have more than one smoke detector, right?
Yeah.
So if a smoke detector is going off in the kitchen and you're in the bedroom, you may not be able to hear that smoke detector because you're way across the house in the bedroom. So Nest Protect, these, because they're connected together, it will sound the alarm in the room that you're in the bedroom, so that you can hear.
Oh.
Yeah. No matter That's where really it's cool. coming from.
It's cool because it's like, okay, I can save my stuff, but it's also really cool because that encourages you to buy multiple devices at $129 each.
Yes.
They're going to be upgraded time after time, so you're going to want the new one with the new features. So Nest is becoming a place where, you know, you can, hey, I need the new safety feature, as opposed to, oh, I bought a thermostat. I can own a thermostat for 40 years, really. But this is like your safety is better. So that's a big deal.
It uses LED lights to illuminate your path as you walk underneath it. When you go to sleep, it'll show a quick green glow after the lights go off to let you know it's still working. If it goes off, you can just wave your hand underneath it to, like, if it gives you a false alarm, you can wave your hand underneath it to shut the alarm off instead of, you know, reaching for a broom and hitting that button way up on the ceiling. So it's essentially all the stuff that we talked about before, except instead of rumors, it's the facts. So Nest Protect, available coming this November, $129. It's a little too pricey for me, but I'm hoping maybe with an economy of scale, more people buy these and buy Nest products in general, that the prices will come down.
Well, you just have to – I mean, Nest has shown that it's more of a question of – when they come out with the next version, then the price will go down.
Yeah. And last big headline before we talk about our video of the week is a video is going around on the internet. Fox News released a video detailing their new set, their new, you know, high-tech interactive set. And in the video, they feature a number of news analysts sitting beside these giant touch interfaces. They essentially look like tiny little journalists in front of huge iPads. It's kind of funny. So these screens measure 55 inches across. They're running Windows 8. It's Microsoft's PPI display technology, which they acquired through their acquisition of Perceptive Pixel in July 2012. Because of that, Microsoft an OEM of the largest touchscreens in the world. They even have an 80-inch variation of this display. That'd be like one of those like futuristic evil villain table displays where they're moving things around on a giant map. Like, I think I saw that in Avatar.
The island also.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the Hunger Games.
Right, exactly. So, but I thought it was fairly, it looks kind of ridiculous. I'm kind of jealous because, like, this giant touchscreen, 55-inch touchscreen display would be ideal for a nonlinear editing system like an Avid or a Final Cut Pro. I would love to work on something like that. It's kind of funny to see these journalists. I mean, I think they chose these huge displays because if you've got because it essentially looks good on TV when you're shooting an entire room of these things, you can pick out individual things on the screens that's being displayed because it's just such a huge display. And also the video featured this sort of a variation on like CNN's interactive wall technology where the host, in this case Shepard Smith, can use like a remote to sort of move the stories off of these giant displays onto the big video wall in the centerpiece of the yeah. set.
You know what? The first thing that came to my mind was this is like Duplex versus Legos, right? Like, you know, we now have these
Duplo,
sorry. You now have these like huge machines, huge screens that people are trying to do tasks on. And I really wonder if you can get that same sort of minute sensitivity that you need for certain things. So like when I was watching part of one of the videos that displayed it, they were really just reordering really simple graphical things, mm-hmm. things that you could use with large finger touches rather than some of the smaller things that you might need like a stylus or something or a more intimate device. So
the question is, like, do these particular displays have that fine sort of motor control over the tiny, tiny objects that, like, you would expect from an iPad, for example?
But if you think about it, we'll be able to see blue screens of death a lot easier.
That stack trace, you'll be able to see every single aspect of it, every single part of the stack. It'd be great.
Oh, man.
Every right. single memory that's being a memory
memory address
that's being, you know, decrypted or I mean not decrypted, being screwed up, corrupted.
We're gonna take one last break, and when we come back, our drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas, Tosin Anafuwakin, and Christopher Bernor. The last time we saw Boston Dynamics' sprinting cheetah robot, our fear for the future of humanity was soothed slightly by the knowledge that it remained tethered for power. Now Boston Dynamics is taking the chains off of its world record holder and letting the next generation of sprinter run. It's gone from cheetah to being called wildcat. It's capable of bounding and galloping across flat terrain at speeds of up to 16 miles per hour. It runs off a two-stroke go-kart engine, and it's capable for running for about 5 minutes, thankfully. So if you can outrun a 16-mile-per-hour weaponized robot cheetah for 5 minutes, then you can probably survive at this point.
But 60 miles an hour is pretty fast to run for 5 minutes.
Yeah,
16 miles an hour, period. It's pretty much like a crocodile can move up to like 12 miles an hour, and it gets its prey in really fast succession, right? So 16 miles an hour, I mean, it's really showing you that this thing can motor. It can move forward.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even have full knee articulation yet. Imagine when it does.
Yeah.
The knees look hilarious.
It looks hilarious now Just wait till, you know, several iterations of this when it gets fine articulation and it's able to, like, and what, like I said, once they weaponize it, my God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it can run in a straight line. It can turn around. It turns around much like it doesn't turn around much like a cat yet, but when it gets full articulation, it'll be able to behave much like a wildcat does when it needs to take down prey, and it's shifting its hips and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it still has like human knee type articulation. When it gets that crazy rear leg type articulation, we're gonna be in trouble.
Yeah,
we're gonna
it's like Resident Evil dogs, or potentially even worse if you've seen Ghost in the Shell.
I feel like we encountered
these really badly. By the way,
you want one?
Oh yeah, could you imagine? Like, who needs a remote control car when I can just pour a little petrol gas into this puppy and get some real action out of it? You know, like we talk about the negative things. When this has an AI engine in it, you can treat it like it's your pet.
Yeah,
I mean, how cool is that going to be? You know,
I feel like we've seen these already in Half-Life Episode 2. This is like a variation on Dog, or even, you know, there were some robots that were operated by the Combine Army that chase you through a forest, I think, in one of the early sequences in Half-Life Episode 2, that this reminds me a lot of. It makes me a little uneasy that we are creating, because this isn't like a pack robot like Big Dog, like Boston Dynamics Big Dog. This is clearly designed for some sort of aggressive intent, you know, to chase something down.
Well, you think this is scary? Imagine when there's seven of them or eight of them going after you, right? Like it's in a pack mentality, like a pride
oh my
of
God.
Wildcats, you know, just chasing you down. That's what's going to be crazy.
Cavalry is making a comeback. We're gonna have cavalry again in our military.
I'm just glad that this is that they're for now at least on our side. Wait till
Well, all this stuff is cool right now. Sure. What's weird is when, just like our F-16s and stuff, we start selling them to other countries,
foreign powers.
Know? Like the military aid we were giving Egypt was like we're not really giving them aid. We give them a budget to buy our weapons. And where does this fit in, you know? With these drones, especially like these land drones now, this is something crazy.
Yeah.
I kind of love it.
Kind of scares me a little. So we're seeing the future. We talked about Skynet earlier in the show. We're seeing the future of Skynet today as well with Boston Dynamics, I feel. All right, so that's gonna do it for our podcast tonight. I'm going to end it by going around the table here, and I'm going to start with Dwayne. Where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always find me at twitter.com/Dwayne. That's twitter.com/Dwayne, DWAYNED. You can also find me at flavors.me/Dwayne D, and on Google Plus at gplus.to/Dwayne D.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
So you can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find my other stuff at ircwebcast.blogspot.com. We'll be updating some of that soon.
All right. Cool. Very cool. And Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online this week?
You can find all of my stuff on my website at chrismonroe.com. You can also find my tweets at Chris Renor. And if you're interested in startups, I curate two lists at startupdigest.com.
Very cool. As for myself, you can find me mainly at twitter.com and facebook.com at Mr. Baby Man. If you just do a Google search for Mr. Baby Man, also you'll find all my work online. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on the Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about, or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. We've already published a lot of stories from contributors, and they've done pretty well, gotten a lot of attention. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.